KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I know of no way that I could buy grain off of a farmer.
Border Patrol agents will see their hours reduced. FBI agents will be furloughed. Federal prosecutors will have to close cases and let criminals go.
It's inconceivable that the Canadian government would close that embassy before they left. If we were at the U.S. embassy, the same as the U.S. embassy wouldn't contemplate closing the office and saying, well, the six of you are on your own now.
It's just not about winning. It's just about being there, being nominated. It's not about, like, trying to win the award.
Yeah, she hired a sports coach to help her with that. That's Oscar-nominated Guvenjane Wallace talking about whether or not she wants to win an Oscar. Okay, that was a little cynical, but, I mean, you know, it's not about winning. It's how you play the game. We're going to talk about that when we talk about the Oscars with Robert Horton in a few moments on weekday on KUOW. President Obama laying out a few of the consequences for the sequester as he sees it. We'll talk about that a little later in the show when John Talton joins us. And the Canadian ambassador, Ken Taylor, talking about things the movie Argo got wrong, which we'll take up in a moment, but not right away, because Vaughn Palmer is here, political correspondent of the Vancouver Sun, former music critic and arts critic for the paper. He can talk about anything, environmental issues, and we're going to do it all. Hello, Vaughn.
Hi, Steve. Just as long as we kind of give me some time to get ready for it if we're going to talk about sports, okay? You know, I sort of don't know much in that area at all, as my friends keep reminding me every time I mangle a sports metaphor.
Well, what do you think? Smoke's gonna probably smoke it there at first base with the Mariners this year. Right?
You see? I don't even know if they're a basketball team or not. So.
All right. Justin Trudeau, Liberal leader. Is he going to run? Is he going to take the helm?
Run? Like, we've got celebrity politics happening here in Canada big time. So, Liberal Party of Canada has fallen on hard times. They're the third party in Canada's parliament now. They used to be the second party. They were more often the government in our history. Had a couple of leaders that went sideways on them, so they've gone celebrity. They're having a leadership contest, and the hare, as he's called, Justin Trudeau, son of former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, is running for the leadership of the party, packing in the crowds, getting all the attention, and the other candidates for the leadership are starting to snipe at him, as you might expect, saying, exactly what has this guy ever done to claim the top job in Canada, other than having the right last name and roguishly handsome good looks?
Well, okay, so that's a good reason to have your party headed by somebody.
You know, celebrity time, and there is a dynasty thing in politics. Although, you know, I would say that I don't think the Bush name, when people ran, when the second generation of Bushes ran, he at least governed a whole state. Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, played off each other's renown, but I don't think anybody disputed that they also both had a pretty impressive resume. In this case, with Trudeau, I think his critics have a point. At the debate last weekend, one of his opponents said, exactly what have you done to qualify you as to be Prime Minister of Canada? The guy asking the question was an astronaut, by the way, Mark Garneau, who was Canada's man in space on a couple of space shuttle missions and in the space station. And Garneau asked the question because, look, if his name were Justin Garneau, I don't think he'd be running for Prime Minister. He's running for Prime Minister because he's Justin Trudeau, riffing off that celebrity. He was a school teacher, which is a perfectly honorable profession. He's independently wealthy because his father was very wealthy. He's a very popular public speaker. In fact, he's made a lot of money on the side speaking. He's been a member of Canada's Parliament. There are 300 of those. You know, he's been he's been an ordinary member of Parliament. I don't think he's ever contributed much to any national debates, but he's clearly the front runner for the leadership of the Liberal Party, and the opinion polls in this country suggest that Canadians are very excited at the magic that he brings to the political arena.
Well, his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was a celebrity and a magical figure as well, international figure.
Yes, he was, but let me make one distinction on that. When Pierre Trudeau entered into Canada's prime ministership in 1968, he was one of the most accomplished intellectuals in the country. He was a major intellectual figure, a constitutional scholar, author of several books on the Canadian Constitution. He had been the country's justice minister and had led to a major modernization of the of Canadian laws. So he was a substantial figure. He was not just as he was. He was a very handsome bachelor and all of that stuff as well. But Pierre Trudeau was a major figure. Justin, I mean, the critics have a point. If his name were Justin Garneau, I don't think he would be the front runner for the leadership of the Liberal Party of Canada.
Who was his mother?
His mother was Margaret Trudeau.
Yeah.
Young woman from Vancouver, Pierre Trudeau married while he was prime minister. There's a long saga there, which, would make a wonderful TV movie if you wanted to do it.
Okay, see, already.
There's a whole business around the Rolling Stones, and never mind. There's a whole play about it, which was done some years ago, which is actually a pretty good play about mother and father. But anyway, you go out there and you go in the political arena. The big concern that the Liberals who are criticizing this is that you can win the party leadership on the celebrity, but then when you have to stand up and defend your own policies, provide political leadership in a country, if you're a lightweight, as his critics say he is, you're up against two very formidable politicians in this country. Thomas Mulcair, leader of the New Democratic Party, former cabinet minister from the province of Quebec, a very sharp guy, and Stephen Harper, who's been prime minister of Canada for 7 years. Neither of those guys would be mistaken for a political lightweight, and, the glow of celebrity can fade very quickly.
I am rooting for celebrity in Canadian politics, Vaughn, so I am going for it.
The media has a clear conflict of interest on this one, Steve. Why am I talking about Justin this morning to you? There's no question that we have a terrible conflict of interest around this, although, again, as the liberal critics say, the media giveth and the media taketh away. They're the only story that is more popular in the news media, more popular than, hey, a celebrity's running for office, is a lightweight celebrity is in public office and they're not cut it out for the job. You build up and then you tear down. So that saga has an arc as well.
True that. True that. Vaughn Palmer is our guest. Vaughn, starting to talk sewage in Victoria. What's happening here?
One of the seven warning signs of sewage treatment has finally arrived here in Victoria, and we've been talking about this on the show for years, and I've been talking about how we're going to get around to building a sewage treatment plant here in Victoria one of these days. Local governments have advised their ratepayers that they're going to start paying this year. So they're talking about bringing in tax increases to start building up a fund to pay for the plant to reduce the payments when it actually comes online in 2018. So I say when the local government's getting around to start hitting us on our tax bills, sewage treatment is at hand. It's actually coming here, and it's going to be expensive. Here in Victoria, in our local government, we're going to hit nearly $400, I think.
A year?
Yeah, $400 a year.
What do you pay?
I think that's lowball. Frankly, I think it'll be more than that. I think they haven't got the place. The thing isn't built. They haven't started construction yet. So my guess is it'll go over budget, and then we have to look at the operating costs as well. So we're expecting $500 a year on our property taxes here in Victoria. Some of the local governments around here have found different ways to do it. They're not paying the same share. So one of my colleagues in my office is gloating that he's going to be paying less than I am. But we'll see. But I think we're all going to be paying a fair amount for it. If they ever get it underway, of course, it wouldn't be sewage treatment here in Victoria without controversy. And the current fuss is over the design of the plant. It will be at the entrance to the harbor, and some people think it's kind of ugly.
Why are they putting it there?
Well, because we built a whole series of communities here at the south end of Vancouver Island without sewage treatment, so all the good sites are taken. There's an old oil tank farm at the entrance to the hallway, so it's not exactly very scenic to begin with. And they're going to remove that and put the sewage treatment plant there to save money. Someone suggested we just put a big sign on the side of it that says sewage, you know. But doesn't Seattle have one that's on the waterfront north of Seattle?
Well, we have the one that's at Discovery Park. It's right on the water there.
It's a hell of a good place to put a sewage treatment plant, I say. I mean, it's on the water.
Shorter pipes.
Nice views for the crews and all that.
So the 2013 monthly sewer rate in Seattle, $39.79 for single-family residences. Is also that rate for commercial and multifamily, but that's a different amount.
But they must have capitalized the cost, right? You've got the plant. We're talking massive amounts of money here to fund the construction. The estimate for construction is $783 million.
Oh, we got you beat with our Brightwater plant. That went way over that. And we just started now spreading that around and paying for that. But
what are you going to do? I mean, we've been taking heat from this for a long, long time. The national government has ordered the city to start treating its sewage. The provincial government has ordered the city. We've been holding the tourist industry at bay for almost as long as you and I have been doing this show. So it's unavoidable, but it is going to be expensive.
Vaughn, let me ask you about this. We heard the clip.
Yes.
Argo up for an Oscar. Canadians are complaining about its lack of complete accuracy.
Has the Academy Awards ever had as much controversy?
Yeah, this is a good one.
They have this year around the alleged accuracy or inaccuracy. I mean, they're movies, folks. They're movies. Right? They are not documentaries. So I've been following the controversy on Zero Dark Thirty and on Lincoln. Well, here in Canada, the big controversy is Argo, which, according to the buzz, is now the favorite. Have you seen Argo?
No, I have not. This is a bad year for me. Have you seen it?
I can't imagine why any Canadian would complain about it. I mean, first of all, the movie.
You guys are heroes.
The movie's funny, first of all, and it's very thrilling, and it's a movie. But the Canadian ambassador in Tehran, who sheltered these six Americans that Ben Affleck goes and rescues, is portrayed as a hero. He's portrayed as a guy. He and his wife put their lives on the line to take these six Americans in when the American embassy was seized. The Americans were turned away. The movie tells you this by the Brits and by the Norwegians. Canada took them in. The movie portrays the Canadian ambassador and his wife as their own safety being at risk. The country, Canada, is portrayed in heroic terms, and so I can't imagine why anybody up here would be bothered by it. It's a very nice, warm film. Everybody knows that the ending of the movie is made up. The very thrilling, edgier seat thriller that they made this movie into, the ending is BS, and the director and the producer and everyone has admitted it, but it works as a movie, and as I said, there have been much less flattering portraits of Canada in the movies over the years. So, I'm not sure what the fuss is about, but there you go. Canadians are up in arms that it's not strictly historically accurate.
Well, you know, it does have Ben Affleck in it, and he directed it, and he is a movie star. He's not a historian, so I guess you're right there.
Well, you know what I found interesting is that there's a good piece in our paper that pointed this out. Like, there's the fuss over Richard III, right? Shakespeare.
Uh huh.
You know, they've dug up Richard's body, and it turns out that they've now concluded that maybe Richard wasn't as bad a guy as Shakespeare made him out to be, right? So even Shakespeare is on the hook for the lack of historical accuracy in his plays.
Let's not forget who was paying his bills.
Yeah. So like, you know, this is not a new story, but it is kind of fun. Everybody will be watching the Oscars in Canada, too. And as I said, we've been called worse things in movies, and Canadians have been called lots worse things in our own movies. So, as I said, I found it a fairly flattering portrait of Canada's role in all this, but there you go.
All right, Vaughn. We'll see what happens in the Oscars next week. I appreciate you talking to us.
Great. Talk to you next, Steve.
Take care. Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. I know the Oscars are, you know, this weekend, but we'll talk to Vaughn next week, and we'll see what he thinks about the Oscar winners. This is Weekday.
It's 10:20, and in a minute here, we'll be joined by Robert Horton to talk some more film. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Pacific University, celebrating their new president with a public lecture, Cultural Shifts, Christian Engagement in a Changing World, with sociologist and author James Davison Hunter. Tuesday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. at SPU. More at spu.edu.
It's cloudy in Seattle and 39 degrees. Forecast says it's going to stay cloudy. Looking at a chance of rain this afternoon and a predicted high today of 46. 10:21, I'm Bernard Ouellette. A look at immigration reform from a business perspective in 20 minutes. But first,
let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Come on, I know every one of you, just like Bernard and I, you raise your arms up at the end to really get that that conclusion in there.
Do they sell lozenges in the lobby?
Yes, right they now? Do. I got some.
Smith Brothers?
I went out and got some Smith Brothers, okay. Came back. That's right. By the way, I didn't get one last story from Vaughn about the Canadian Cardinal Mark Ouellette, touted as a top prospect to replace the resigning Pope. Now, Bernard, is that your cousin, your uncle?
Well, I don't know, but let's just say yes, he's a cousin.
All right, that sounds
Canadian
good.
Cousin.
Canadian cousins all the way. They look alike. They talk alike. Bernard and
well,
they
don't talk alike.
You see my hat, my big tall hat.
That'd be great if we had a name with the Pope. So we'll see if Mark Ouellette gets the...
What if he's chosen and then takes as his Pope name Pope Bernard?
Whoa!
What then?
I think you're going to the Vatican, baby. That'd be a movie. Lowly radio host goes to the Vatican.
I think that's been made. I think that's been done, actually.
No.
Plot of a Preston Sturges film from the... Maybe it was not made. I don't know.
I like that.
Yeah.
He was just a humble cleric.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, he's the Pope. And he doesn't like the way those corrupt cardinals are running things. Mm. And he's gonna filterize them until they... I just made that word up.
Yeah.
Robert Horton is here. He is a correspondent, a reviewer of films for the Herald and Everett. You got new bosses. Washington Post is sold.
That's what they
are going to be working for Nickel Ads, little Nickel Ads. So you'll have to put a little, we'll write for food.
I already do that.
He also is at the Fry Art Museum and with a lecture series, and he helped bring us the Mohai Cinema exhibit.
That's Celluloid Seattle.
It's at Mohai.
A city at the movies, yes.
And you were saying there's something we should just, let's start with that real quick. What are they doing?
Well, you know, for the third year in a row, Mohai, the Museum of History and Industry, is sponsoring a competition for short films. And it is, it goes under the theme, History is blank. And people who enter the contest fill in the blank with a word or a phrase and make a up to 5-minute movie that talks about history in some interesting way. An overview of some sort, or maybe a personal history of some kind, local history,
that.
Anything else. And it's been fun to watch the last couple of years of how that's played out. And anybody can do it. You don't need to be a filmmaker or a film student, although if you are, this is a kind of a nice chance to get your stuff shown, and you can win, prizes and And I think the winner even gets there's a gala involved in which the films are screened and so on.
Now, you were saying, and by the way, mohai.org/film shows up there. History is. Submit your films, all these things, third annual. You were saying that somebody who won last time was somebody you heard us talking about it a few years back?
I think it was 2 years ago, yeah, that the winner was a filmmaker who happened to be listening to you and I talking about the competition in exactly the same way we are now, and decided to make a film and under this theme and enter it, and he ended up winning the top prize.
January 1st to March 31st are submissions, and then the winner will be announced on May 4th and the awards gala on May 11th. History is.
So you've got time, a little time left.
Yeah. I like it. Yeah. I like it. Tell me, historical accuracy in films, Argo, Lincoln. Maureen Dowd was writing about this. Why are people concerned? Killing Lincoln, I believe there was some critique about the new documentary that was filmed based on Papa Bear's book.
Yes. Well, if you make a documentary, you probably should try to get things right.
Well, you know, he works for Fox News.
Yes.
He has his facts and you have yours.
Yeah. Well, this is, of course, a thorny issue that we've often engaged here, and it depends on your threshold. It depends on your ability to go to a movie with, you know, big time actors and sets and costumes, and have the ability to understand that not everything is exactly as it was. Dialogue has been made up, incidents may have been compressed, characters, so on, and certainly also, I mean, at some point you also develop some sort of antenna, don't you? I mean, when I was watching Argo, like most people, it's a fairly obscure true story, so I didn't know too many details, but I won't give anything away. But when, you know, cars are chasing down the runway of an airport and the plane is about to take off, I had a pretty good idea that probably didn't really happen, and it didn't.
What?
There's a bit of hype that takes over that movie in the last half hour or so in terms of drawing out suspense. You could argue about whether or not that was even necessary, since it was already a rather suspenseful story, and maybe a straight factual account would have been just as gripping, but it seems to have worked out for Argo.
Well, I understand Lincoln dies at the end of Lincoln, which I was disappointed to find.
Well, spoiler alert, I guess, but yes.
Do you know what the critique was of Lincoln, where it was historically inaccurate for the buffs?
People have talked about, I think mostly that tends to be sort of minutia that people have been talking about with Lincoln. That it's,
not killing Lincoln, but Lincoln, Spielberg's Lincoln.
Yeah, Spielberg's Lincoln, that it maybe it compresses things. And there are a couple of characters who are not historical characters. They are composites. They're standing in for a certain kind of person who was around at that time. I mean, that is the stuff of the usual historical film. That's certainly not very unusual at all for that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, but then you've got the other thing is the Quentin Tarantino approach to history, which is sort of this hilariously inspired idea that in Inglourious Basterds, Hitler actually gets killed by people in a movie theater or nearby, and there's some sort of gratification about that. And in Django Unchained, there's a huge uprising at a plantation that results in it's sort of like Mad Magazine's Scenes We'd Like to See.
Uh-huh.
You remember that whole feature? It's like, yes, I would kind of like to see a slave revolt that was triumphant. And Tarantino just blithely gives you that.
Well, there's a lot of history that wasn't given to us, wasn't recorded, that who knows, but there were people just like the characters in Django Unchained who seized on their own freedom and reality, and, you know, we're not the victims that they're always portrayed to be.
Well, Tarantino certainly is interested in reworking some of that stuff for his own purposes, and it strangely kind of gets to some interesting material in the course of being as outrageous as he is.
Bill O'Reilly's Killing Lincoln was barred from the Ford Theater bookstore. He admits there were four minor misstatements, but overall it's overblown, and they're just doing it because the liberal media is trying to keep his books out of people's hands.
I see.
But they're not succeeding because it is a bestseller.
Apparently not.
All right. There's your historical accuracy. I am excited about Noir City, Seattle International Film Festival's Noir City, Week of Revivals, Eddie Mueller, the king of noir, Czar of Noir, I believe is what he's called, right?
Yeah, that's somebody calls him that, yeah.
Probably himself. But some movies here I've never heard of. When does this start? When does this get underway?
I believe it's this coming weekend.
He has an intimate fireside chat with on February 21st at the SIFF.
Okay.
And I don't see who he's chatting with, but it must be here somewhere. But
and then Friday it begins in earnest.
Oh, with Sean Axemaker.
Is that right? I'll be darned.
Former, Stranger film critic? PI film critic?
PI film critic, yes.
Yeah. Excuse me, did reviews for The Stranger. All right. Cry Danger, Robert Parrish. That was pretty good. I remember that one.
Yes, that is a good film.
That starts it out.
Right. And it's a collection of things that is, at this point, you know, these film noir festivals keep happening, and at a certain point they run through the main well-known noir titles, and they get more and more esoteric as they go along. And this is one of those where you look at it and it's like, wow, that is a somewhat bizarre collection of films.
This is where they get good. Cry Danger was crazy.
Yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
It is a goodie.
Dick Powell.
There are movies that don't really fit anybody's definition of noir.
Like Deported, Robert Sidomax, Deported, about Lucky Luciano's enforced return to his roots. An ultra rarity, the hardest to find of Sidomax American films, 1950. Is that on this one? Am I in the right year? I am in the right year, aren't I? Am I a year off?
I think you're reading from an old list.
Oh, look, yes. I am. I'm from 2010. Excuse me,
well,
people.
You got to get with it.
I just did a quick search to get my link, and I'm all wrong. So.
Well, luckily, we're not live.
So yeah.
I'll give you a couple of films that jumped out at me.
Some accurate ones, you mean?
Yes, the ones that are actually in the thing. And I don't know if Sean Axemaker is involved in this at all, by the way. For instance, one of the things where you're really starting to bend out of shape the definition of film noir, which tends to be associated with late 1940s into the 1950s, darkish melodramas from America. There are a couple of films by notable directors from the early 1930s in this selection. A House Divided, William Wyler, future Oscar-winning director, made in 1931, a movie with Walter Huston. And it's double-billed with A Kiss by the Mirror, which was one of the film's interesting projects directed by James Whale after he did Frankenstein and before he did Bride of Frankenstein.
Now is it legitimate to...
Well, this is a thing that will be debated, I suppose, and I could debate it. But actually, I have to say that anything that... If it takes bending the definition of film noir out of unrecognizable shape in order to put movies like this on the screen in 35mm prints, which I assume they are, I'm not sure, in front of audiences that might never have been exposed to them, then go ahead and bend it, because some of these movies are, you know, really tantalizing, and some of them are undiscovered gems, and some of them are just really good movies that are not well known to film history, but it's kind of awesome that they're getting an airing in a situation like this.
What is an undiscovered gem from that list?
You know, I'm intrigued by I can tell you an actual film noir gem that sort of has been discovered in recent years called The Window, which is a story about a boy in a film noirish situation. And that's a movie that reputation has kind of increased over the last few years, partly because it gets trotted out for film noir festivals like this. It's one of those movies that people say, hey, this is an undiscovered gem, until at some point it becomes discovered, I guess. And that one is being double billed with a movie that probably ought to be discovered a little bit more, called Experiment in Terror, which is early 60s movie from Blake Edwards, director who's usually better known for comedies and... around the same time he made The Days of Wine and Roses. And Experiment in Terror has Lee Remick in it, and it is a... You would define it as sort of late noir, since it's early 60s, but it's definitely a really creepy little movie, a very sustained piece of suspense.
Cool. Glenn Ford, Stephanie Powers, Ross Martin. I finally found the right page.
Yes, Ross Martin, favorite actor of...
It takes, I mean, the Wild Wild West, right?
Yeah, later, a couple years later, he'd be on the Wild Wild West. So therefore, one of my favorite actors of childhood.
How about this one, Intruder in the Dust?
Yes.
Faulkner novel.
Right.
Adaptation. 1949.
Yeah, and it's playing on a double bill with an early film adaptation of Native Son that actually stars the author of Native Son, Richard Wright.
Really?
He acts in the film. And it's not shown very often. It's an interesting movie, kind of a strange film, but it's a really interesting kind of historical artifact.
I guess I can see how you might call Native Son a noir story, in that it is anti-heroes up against a machine or the man.
Yeah,
and
a murder
down.
Involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely could fit into the profile. There's a couple of 3D films that they're offering, and I've never seen either of these movies, so I can't say whether they're just how noirish they are, but it's I assume they're going to have, you know, glasses and everything, and they're presenting them in 3D prints. Man in the Dark is one of them, and Inferno is the other one.
Wow.
Yeah.
Edmund O'Brien, pinched by the cops, crook Steve Raleigh undergoes an experimental operation to eliminate his criminal urges.
Yes. Yeah.
Man in the Dark, 3D.
And I think Robert Ryan is in Inferno. Robert Ryan, a key film noir, usually bad guy, though not always bad guy, and a terrific actor, which makes it kind of a must-see, I think, right there.
He's the bad guy in this one.
Throw in the 3D and you got yourself...
He's crippled.
Got yourself an evening. He's been left in the desert or something like that, too.
Yep. Yeah. Left for dead in the scorching desert. I think we all know what that is going to engender.
Well, it can't be good.
No.
I don't know. I haven't seen the film. But
this is exciting. I think this is great. Now, I think Ross Reynolds is talking to Eddie Mueller tomorrow.
Okay.
I shall check in a moment.
Right.
But these are films, as you say, bending the definition, but bringing us some pretty interesting things, huh?
Yeah. As I say, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that a bunch of these movies are actually noir, but go ahead and unreel them. I think if it gets them seen on a big screen, whatever it takes.
Yeah, the Czar of Noir will be on the combo tomorrow at 12:35 is what I'm reading now, so you can find out more about that.
Now, you know, before there was this traveling noir series, our own Seattle Art Museum was doing noir before it was cool to do noir, Steve, going back 30 years now. And speaking of the Seattle Art Museum, they have their spring, they tend to have quarterly series, and they have a spring series coming up that is worth highlighting. Two masters of the French New Wave will be showcased here in alternating weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Weeks.
Godard and Truffaut.
Yeah,
huh?
the two big guns, Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut. And 35 millimeter prints are promised for these. So see them the way they ought to be seen, the way they should be seen.
How's Trudeau stand for you? How you doing with Trudeau these days? You see
Trudeau. You're going Canadian again.
Can you tell what happens when a person gets a little bit of extra stuff up in the head there?
Right. That's all right.
Yes. Yeah. Trudeau was a great filmmaker. And I like his cartoon, too.
He had his moment, yeah.
How is Truffaut?
Well,
how's he standing up?
Standing in history, yeah.
No, his films. When you watch his films, how do they play for you?
Oh, well, for me, they play fantastically well. And he was a brilliant filmmaker. Made a half dozen superb films and a bunch of really good ones. Maybe a couple of duds in there as well. But it's an awfully good batting average. I think they've aged beautifully. And I'm a huge fan for Truffaut. In his life, of course, he died at in his early 50s, and so film history he begins to recede quite a bit because it's been 30 years since then. Jean-Luc Godard still around, still making films, still causing various levels of ruckus whenever he puts out a new movie, goes around the film festival circuit, and people get to argue about what it is. And
I like that.
Still causing problems.
So that's it, Sam. All right, give me a...
That starts on April 4th.
All right. Best actress, who's going to win?
Best actress, you know, it's probably...
Will it be the little girl? Oscar prediction?
I think probably Jennifer Lawrence for Silver Linings Playbook. That seems to be sort of the consensus now. People are gathering around her performance.
How about best actor?
Well, I think Daniel Day-Lewis has probably got that one locked up. So
that's just everybody else is going just to go to the party.
Yeah.
And how about best film?
Well, as the film critic Von Palmer was saying earlier, Argo does, it seems to have...
Over the Lincoln. Argo over the Lincoln.
Yeah, there's somehow these murmurs that Lincoln was it's not as lovable, it's not as cute, it's not as fun as Argo. I think Lincoln is exactly the kind of movie that usually wins the Oscars, so it's kind of surprising that and then Argo got slighted because Ben Affleck didn't get nominated for Best Director, therefore this is going to be a sympathy vote.
Oh yeah, and the sympathy vote. All right.
Spielberg might win Best Director, though.
All right. That'll be fun.
Yeah. We'll
Oscar
see.
Parties.
We'll see.
It's good to talk to you again, sir.
Nice talking to you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
It's 10:40. 43 degrees at the moment, expecting to hit 46 at some point today. These clouds are going to stay with us, possibly bringing some rain this afternoon. Chance of rain overnight and tomorrow as well.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, committed to helping members fulfill their resolutions for a healthy new year by providing weekly organic fruit and vegetable delivery service throughout the greater Seattle area. Now serving Everett, Issaquah, Bellevue, Tacoma, and Puyallup. More at tinysorganic.com.
An African-American family in Chicago gets an insurance windfall and decides to move to a better neighborhood.
Mama, there ain't no colored people living in Clyburn Park.
Well, there's gonna be some there now.
A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Friday night at 10 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Moore Center for Eating Disorders, committed to providing compassionate and comprehensive care for adolescents and adults with eating disorders through their partial hospitalization and outpatient programs for over 20 years. More information at moorecenterclinic.com.
I'm Bernard Willett. It's 10:41. Ex-Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. pleaded guilty today in federal court to misuse of campaign cash. That's at the top of our newscast in 20 minutes.
John Talton is here now, economics blogger, novelist, writes at the Seattle Times about the economy. It's good to see you again, sir.
I am happy to be here, Steve.
I just want you to take. I was saying to Robert, there didn't seem to be many economics movies this time around in the Oscars or otherwise, and you beg to differ with me.
Well, I think you could make the argument that Lincoln had an economics backdrop to it, in that throughout the first 5 decades of the 19th century, so much American policy was built around extending slaveholding. And that slaves built so much of the American economy. The biggest export of America was cotton, picked by, as Lincoln would say, the bondsman under the lash. And the big argument was, if we gradually abolish slavery, how do we compensate the slaveholders for this? And then what do we do with the slaves? Do we colonize them to Africa or whatever? This is a huge argument going into the Civil War. Lincoln, who was a Whig before he was a Republican, he wouldn't be a Republican now, probably.
But he might be a Whig again, though.
He might, but he didn't wear a wig. But he of course, was foursquare against slavery, but was very much in this debate about how do we compensate the slaveholders. So there is an economic backdrop.
Yeah, I think that's great to remember, because it is important to remember how much of this country existed and how important it was to those Southern slaveholders. It was an economic argument, they felt. They talk about the culture and this and that. But
well, I mean, when Andrew Jackson broke solemn treaties and stole the land of the 5 civilized tribes in the southeastern United States, leading to the Trail of Tears, etc., this was all about white supremacy gaining control of very fertile land upon which could grow cotton. You know, tobacco is a terrible crop. It burns out land, burned out the land of Virginia. But in especially in getting control of the Black Belt in Mississippi and Alabama, the slaveholders were able to produce this amazing export crop called cotton that the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain ran on.
Context. It's all about context.
Yes,
nicely
sir.
Argued. Now, context for the sequester and its consequences.
Well, the sequester is entirely artificial. It is as if we said, and I'm sorry to be so timely about it, it's as if we said, let's go out and buy a gun and some ammo and load it and put it to our heads and cock the hammer back and say on March 1st we're going to pull the trigger. That's essentially what we're doing here. We don't need to be cutting government spending right now. We need to cut government spending in the long term. We certainly need to cut defense spending. But the sequester was this artificial legislative thing set up so that March 1st, $85 billion in cuts go into effect, and it's a meat cleaver across the board. They don't get to say that this gets cut and that doesn't get cut, so everything gets cut. But the broader issue is that right now with the economy just barely recovering and unemployment still near 8%, the last thing we need to be doing is cutting government spending. Reagan didn't cut government spending. Reagan expanded government spending. It was one of the things that was responsible for the economy recovering in 83, 84.
Allow me to channel my good friends over at the Tea Party for a moment.
Oh, yeah.
$85 billion out of a multi-trillion dollar budget. You'll never see these kinds of defense cuts so quickly. And yes, there will be hard cuts to the discretionary spending, but that could come back. If you were on the far left and saw these defense cuts, you might weigh that against what impact it will have short term on the economy.
Well,
that really wasn't a very good Tea Party channeling, because they, of course, don't want to really cut defense, but they're willing to go for it because they want to see smaller government, so they say.
Well, so they say. I mean, we don't need to be spending more on defense than the next 17 largest powers combined, and that includes Russia and our good friends, the Red Chinese.
But it's hard to cut defense.
No, it's not. Ike did it. Harry Truman did it. Every time that we've ended a war...
Well, Obama's doing it in that.
Not really, but every time that we've ended a war, we have cut back defense spending, and we've cut it back substantially. And now we're told, oh, no, we can never cut defense spending, but we've got to cut everything else. The deficit's coming down. The debt is coming down. And on top of that, we borrow in our own currency. And so we're not going to be Greece. We have historically low interest rates. So this would be the time to build a high-speed rail system, finance it at 2% interest, and go for it. But the Tea Party mainly wants Obama to fail. They want to, as Jim DeMint of South Carolina famously said, break him. And so the sequester cuts are not the way to do this. Now, as far as defense goes, there's a lot of hysteria going on right now. So we're not going to have the Blue Angels, and they're going to cut all these air shows around the country.
Horrors.
And meanwhile, they spent wasted hundreds of millions of dollars on the F-35, which still doesn't fly right. And we're not going to fix that. We're going to cut the Blue Angels. So there's a tremendous amount of PR going on to whip people up.
So then are you arguing that intelligent voices will reign supreme and we will get measured, credible cuts across the board in the future?
Well, you know me, and one of my favorite quotes is Abba Ibn, where he said, when all else fails, men turn to reason. But I don't think that's the case in D.C. I mean, we have one of our two great political parties that has been captured by ideological extremists. And this is really the first time in American history that this has happened to a mass political party. And so this is the new version of the government shutdown. There seems to be no willingness to stop it. Obama is no Ronald Reagan as far as being able to articulate what needs to happen.
You think he's not articulating it well?
I think he's not articulating it well, and maybe the media echo chamber has changed so much that it's difficult for a president to get the message across.
Because he's been going around the country making cases for high-speed rail and saying, look, postmen and policemen and firemen are going to be out of work in a month.
Well, the
teachers.
When you have the House captured by extremists, the House disposes of the budget. The Senate can slow the passions of the mob, as the founders intended, but the House reflects popular passions, and the House has undue control over the budget, constitutionally a right thing to do. But the framers never imagined that this kind of extremist control could happen.
Spin out for me what happens March 10th if sequester goes through March 1st. What's the economy look like?
You're going to have a major slowdown. You probably will have a recession. You'll have increased joblessness. You'll have much more suffering on the part of the least and the last and the lost who will be kicked off of poverty programs. Then you will have a lot of defense posturing where they'll say, oh, my gosh, we have to take an aircraft carrier out of the Persian Gulf. But in the macroeconomic sense, this is going to be a major drag on the economy.
The president has made that case, and he's told people across the country, write your Congress member. Any evidence? Have you seen any evidence that that is moving people? I haven't.
No, I think one big difference between now and 1981, when Ronald Reagan could go over the heads of an entrenched Congress, is that now the Tea Party controls the House, and every House member who is a Republican is afraid of a challenge in the primary from the farther right, or the further right, as you would have it. And so the pull is always to the right. We've accepted as a given that our biggest problem is the debt and the deficit. Well, it is not, but we've accepted that, and that just shows you how far to the right the center of the conversation has turned.
What do you think happens here in the Northwest if sequester goes through? Because it's a huge defense area, but we have Amazon, we have Boeing, which we'll get to in a moment, we have Microsoft leading the charge on healthier efforts in the economy.
We have this two-track recovery where on the one hand there are the big winners whom you just mentioned, and on the other hand we have unusually high joblessness in Washington State. It's even worse down in Oregon, and so the two tracks diverge even more. The companies that are doing well will continue to do well. The people who are doing badly will be hurt even more, but you will have consumer spending hurt. That can't be good for Amazon, Nordstrom, REI, et cetera.
One thing that was very interesting when I had the privilege to talk to Al Gore was his argument about robo-sourcing, that the jobs that are, even the jobs in industrial components that are coming back or areas that are coming back are going to be robots. And we are facing a more sustained and systemic job loss. You agree with that?
I do. I think that we
robots will be doing the work, I should say.
And right now in the Seattle Times newsroom, they are installing the John Talton bot, and it comes complete with martini glass and cigar, and it can do everything I can do.
But they have journalists doing work. They have computers doing journalists' work.
I'm not joking.
Yeah.
at least I don't have to file a blog when I get off this show. But yes, this is an absolute crisis, and you have to wonder when does it stop, because in the 1920s, 2 million people worked for American railroads. Today, about 200,000 work for American railroads. So we went through that transformation, and new jobs were created in new sectors. But if you are economist Robert Gordon at Northwestern University, you are arguing that the big leaps forward, electricity, telephones, the internet, the web, all of these things have been done. And we are all out of big leaps forward. Meanwhile, we face these huge demographic issues of a less educated population, et cetera. that are going to mean very slow growth and very slow job creation. Companies have found they can get by with a lot less as far as their workforce goes. And robots, that's a future column, are going to be a major threat.
John Talton is the economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He blogs as Rogue Columnist at roguecolumnist.com. And he's the author of 10 mystery and thriller novels. The 10th is coming out in
May.
May. I always forget. I'm sorry.
The Night Detectives.
Good. What did you make, speaking of changes in our economy, what did you make of the SPIA vote? We had the engineers and the technical workers of the Boeing company under the SPIA union. The professional workers voted to accept the contract and not authorize a strike. The technical workers, a smaller cohort but still substantial, voted to reject the contract and authorize a strike. What happens going forward here? And how does that affect, you know, Boeing?
If I sound a little groggy, it's because I was up late last night with this. The union is split on this. The techs are more militant, more willing to strike. There is theoretically the ability of the technical workers to go on strike, as I understand it. But I don't think a strike will happen. I think they'll go back to bargaining. And for now, the status quo will reign. But it shows an interesting split in the union. And even among the techs, the vote was not this absolute lopsided, we reject the contract and we want to strike.
No, it was what was in the text, 2,800 voting to accept, 3,200 voting to reject.
Right.
But in professional too, 6,400 voting to accept, 5,500 voting to reject. So they are split. How does that affect, going forward, Boeing's effort to get the 787 back up in the air?
I think the biggest problem is in Chicago and not the Puget Sound region, in the sense that, number one, the board has shown absolutely no willingness to take control of this issue and independently oversee management fixing this problem. Chicago thought they could do it on the cheap. Chicago just outsourced the battery with the most minimal requirements. And so all of this has kind of gotten out of the tent, and Boeing doesn't have the control over it that it once did. Boeing always bought batteries from somebody else, but they laid down very precise engineering specifications. Now we've got to fix it, not North Charleston. And the clock is ticking. There is still not a clear answer as to what was causing these problems. Japanese regulators today, I believe, said that in the one plane that the lithium ion battery was
improperly wired.
Yeah, improperly wired. But I don't know if this is still an answer. Now the regulators were lapdogs as this thing was going along, but now in Debbie Herzman, who is the head of the I believe the NTSB now. She is not a lapdog, and she is going to be tough on this. We were already in a situation where it was going to take years for the Dreamliner to make up its costs, and every time that this setback lingers, the costs increase, and then Airbus is coming out with its own competing carbon composite airliner.
Interesting times. All right, John Talton, economics columnist for the Seattle Times, blogging at roguecolumnist.com. His 10th book coming out in May, 9 mystery and thriller novels. I've read a few. I've enjoyed them. I endorse them.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
It's weekday. And sound or no sound, Bernard, what do you think?
Let's do it.
All right, sound of the day.
And now, the sound of the day.
And two, and one, and two, and here we go.
That's the sound of a tap class warming up at the Century Ballroom. Oh, I hope those people paid their tax. You heard about the opportunity to dance. Class is taught by Josh Scribner. Weekday listener Keith recorded the sound as his daughter danced with her intermediate class, a collection of dancers aged 15 to over 50. If you have an interesting sound like that, send it to us. Record 30 seconds, email it to Sound of the Day, weekday at kuow.org. Talk to you again tomorrow.
An influential member of the 1960s psychedelic rock movement has died. Ken Ayers, founder of the band Soft Machine, was 68. News headlines in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Photograph 51 is the nickname given to an X-ray image of DNA taken in 1952. Photograph 51 is also the title of a play about the woman who made that image, Rosalind Franklin. I'm Marcy Silman. Join me March 2nd for Seattle Repertory Theater's matinee show of Photograph 51. With KUOW's Front Row Center, you can get discount tickets to the play plus a post-show conversation with its...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.